Next case on for oral argument this morning is Scheffler versus Helgett and others. Counsel, while you're getting situated, I'll just remind you of our rules. It's probably been a while since you've been in live, and so we have to reacclimate ourselves. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we do keep track of the proceedings by audio recording. And with that, counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Good morning, Judge Ross. Good morning, Judge Sleater. Good morning, Judge Cochran. I'm Peter Nikitas. I represent Troy K. Scheffler. In this case, Scheffler against Helgett. Mr. Scheffler states claims that survive Rule 12.02e de novo review. The district court made 21 bullet-pointed errors in failing to apply Rule 12.02 properly, as he noted at principal brief pages 25 to 29. Respondents' 25 citations to materials filed before and outside the first amended verified complaint sink their flawed arguments. The district court erred. Respondents misstated the law for Rule 12, Rule 12 conversion to Rule 56, and immunity. Mr. Scheffler anticipates that the respondents may, at this late hour, argue for alternative affirmance. This vain ploy defies facts and law. Their cherry-picked citations to materials outside the first amended verified complaint highlight key omissions from their own exhibits that vindicate Mr. Scheffler's claims, defeat immunities at Rule 12 and Rule 56, and make this case worthy of jury trial. The Court of Appeals should reverse, remand, and publish this case. A summary of the facts follows. This case is a two-chapter story. Chapter 1 begins with Breeden's menacing moves against Scheffler on US 10 and ends with Breeden rear-ending Scheffler's vehicle. The pistol was never alleged to have been used while the vehicles were in transit. What transpired on the highway is a matter the Department of Public Safety continued to investigate after returning Scheffler's pistol.
Mr. Nikitas, go back to part of a summary you made, and I see it in your brief. I assume it's undisputed, or your client does not disagree with the fact that the amended complaint specifically references all those documents that the judge considered as part of her Rule 12 order.
On the contrary, Your Honor, the documents that the district court considered were documents that the defendants submitted. Mr. Scheffler did indeed submit documents on his own, and the...
Well, in particular, the DVD, the video, was incorporated in the complaint, and it references, I'm looking at paragraph 165 of the complaint, Mr. Scheffler attaches and incorporates to this amended complaint one DVD which contains recording of Mr. Scheffler's 911 call, the body-worn camera of Helgett and fellow state patrol officers. Mr. Scheffler attaches and incorporates to this amended complaint Anoka County, Sherburne County documents, and then I think one paragraph 178, all 911 dispatch communications, et cetera. So I guess what I'm asking you, what particular document did the judge rely on other than what your client submitted as part of the complaint?
The defendant's recordings, Your Honor. That was document 23A in the docket. Your Honor, Judge Sleater, you bring up a great point about references to materials outside the complaint. I'll address that in a moment because the state Supreme Court has been very clear about what can and what cannot be considered outside the boundaries of a complaint or amended complaint.
Counsel, just to clarify, when you say the defendant's recordings, what exactly are you referring to?
I'm referring to audio and video recordings that appear at document 23 Alpha and 23 Bravo of the Index for Actions. These are exhibits that the defendants submitted before Mr. Scheffler's first amended verified complaint. They are documents outside the first amended verified complaint. So with chapter two begins with the v- vehicles on the shoulder, and ends with Helgett seizing Scheffler's pistol. Mr. Scheffler's amended verified complaint in chronological recapitulation of Chapter 2 from the respondent's own evidence shows, one, Mr. Scheffler was locked in the squad for 28 minutes and handcuffed for 17. Document 23A, 28 minutes, 25 seconds into it, omitted by the district court and the respondents, records Helgett saying, quote, "This guy is a big boy," referring to Breeden. I would have done the same thing. He, Scheffler, has a legal right to protect himself. First Amendment verified complaint, paragraph 154, lifts that up. We cite the Seventh Circuit's Federal Mutual Insurance Company case that holds its reversible error to cherry-pick findings at Rule 12, and they remanded. Trooper Helgett showed disdain for Mr. Scheffler at 29:35. Quote, "He's already one of those types about protection." 30 minutes in, Mr. Officer Helgett takes the handcuffs off Scheffler and keeps him in the squad. At 31:35, Trooper Helgett starts to grill Mr. Scheffler about the nature and...
To be clear, your client had indicated it was uncomfortable, the handcuffs, correct?
Not only did he... Yes, he indicated they were uncomfortable, Your Honor, but he also raised a claim for excessive force because he was jammed into the squad, handcuffed,
right,
and injured his shoulder.
You were mentioning the handcuffs removed. I gather that you're... correct me if I'm reading too much into it. I gather your point is once the handcuffs were removed, it was clear that the trooper recognized there wasn't a crime, and therefore it was improper for him to keep him detained in the car. I thought the reason the handcuffs were removed, though, was to for your client's comfort while the investigation was ongoing.
That inference is more properly lifted out in discovery after remand, Your Honor. But the time of the respondent's video recordings set a timeline for what happened, when the handcuffing took place, when the handcuffing ceased, and when the grilling about the disabilities continued.
Well, was there any, I'm just curious whether, and I could be totally wrong, whether there's any fact that would contradict or lead to a different reasonable interpretation than the one that I've suggested.
That he removed the handcuffs on account of comfort.
Yes.
The respondents don't make such a point, and Mr. Scheffler makes simply the point that while he was handcuffed, he suffered the injury to his shoulder that necessitated months of physical rehabilitation and medical care. So it's not uncomfortable handcuffs that gives rise to an excessive force case. It's the injury to his shoulder, just to be clear, Your Honor. And thank you for allowing us to lift that up.
Mr. Mindaitis, on that point, for example, and getting back to my original question, it
looks
to me like the judge made numerous references, and I want a paragraph, well, I see it's on page 11 of the judge's order. All of the three Fourth Amendment violation claims by plaintiff can be addressed by reviewing the squad tape and audio. And am I not correct that that's what was referenced in your client's amended complaint, has both audio, and so that goes to Judge Ross's question. All the evidence that one would ever receive is simply in terms of whether the offer was reasonable under these circumstances involving the handcuff and the length of the detention and all those related issues, Fourth Amendment related Terry type stop issues, the judge had properly before it in a Rule 12 motion because it's incorporated in your client's complaint.
The district court heard. I'm glad you brought that point up, Judge Sleater, because I'm skipping ahead to some of the cases about conversion between Rule 12 and Rule 56 that highlight the error and highlight the respondents.
Clarify though that point about the handcuff. The audio, the court's order refers to documents your client did include as part of the complaint and specifically referenced it.
The district court's order refers to documents that Mr. Scheffler raised. The state Supreme Court is very clear on what to do with documents outside a complaint when they're cited.
But weren't those attached to the complaint?
They were incorporated, they were filed, and yes, they were...
So how are they outside of the complaint?
Okay, that's a great question, because the Supreme Court in the NSP case, citing Martins, which the respondents miscited, directs us to look only at the statements that appear outside the amended, requires us to look at the statements in the materials outside the complaint that are in the outside documents. You don't get to look at anything else, okay? You just look if the statements appear on the complaint and you find them in the outside materials, that's what you get to look at.
Clear on what you're saying. So you're saying that the video, even though it was attached and referenced in the complaint, is not material that the court can consider in a Rule 12 motion?
It is not material to consider it. The video itself, outside of what is put in the complaint, is not material. There is the...
You say it's not material. I mean,
you can't...
You're saying it's inappropriate for the district court to base a Rule 12 decision on the video.
It's reversible error to make a Rule 12 disposition based on the video. It might be appropriate at Rule 56, and
what is the case that most strongly supports that proposition? If a video or an audio is referenced by and attached to and submitted with the complaint, that it is outside the bounds of Rule 12 for the district court to consider.
Okay. State Supreme Court decision on NSP, okay, and rebuking the Department of Transportation for misciting Martins. We cited the cases outside the jurisdiction, Jones against Cincinnati, and the Federated Mutual Insurance case from the Seventh Circuit. And
which of those cases do you believe most closely mirrors and supports your argument?
Well, the Federated is a better case, but they're both good cases, Your Honor. And I'd like to have some time to talk about my Second Amendment claim if I can. But Federated made a real point that the district court was cherry-picking materials outside the pleadings. And that was reversible error. And that's exactly what happened at the district court. The district court cherry-picked, completely omitted Trooper Helgett's material admissions that he had a right to defend himself, and he would have done the same thing if it were he. That's reversible cherry picking, and that alone will get us to trial, or at least to remand. Now, when it comes to the Second Amendment, Your Honor, and that's an important part of this case. The Second Amendment recognizes the unalienable individual pre-political right to self-defense anywhere, anytime. Heller from the Supreme Court applied that to the feds. McDonald applied it to the states. And even before the McDonald case, the Minnesota legislature recognized the individual right of self-defense under the Second Amendment in 2003 with the Concealed Carry Act.
I don't know that that's in dispute. I mean, I understand the force your argument has with it, but I'm not sure that that's a matter that's in significant legal dispute.
It is in significant legal dispute, Judge Ross, because the respondents are minimizing the significance of that statute, because the state Supreme Court in the Endicum case in 2012 and the Craig case in 2013 upheld that's the statute and recognized the Second Amendment individual right. And Endicum particularly uplifted the portions of the Concealed Carry Act and recognized that the purpose of it was to protect the freedoms of law-abiding citizens, which Mr. Scheffler clearly is in this case. And the Hatch case from the Supreme Court held the same thing in 2021, and held that the Second Amendment is a fundamental right, the right of self-defense, and that the concealed carry statute is narrowly tailored to serve a compelling interest. Or said differently, if an officer acts outside the bounds of the concealed carry statute, she or he is violating the Second Amendment. So that right was clearly established long before this incident in February of 2018. Now, I know that the U.S. Supreme Court decided the Bruin case on June 23rd this year, and they followed Heller, and they followed McDonald, and they struck down the New York permit to carry statute. A concurrence by Justice Kavanaugh noted that 43 statutes were perfectly good, including Minnesota's. The respondents had 13 days to comment on that decision before their brief was due, and they haven't said a word about it.
Counsel, did Bruin address the ability or the lawfulness of...
I see my time is up, Judge Ross. I'll answer the judge's question, and I'll reserve my five.
You will have 5 minutes of rebuttal either way, but...
Thank you, Your Honor.
Maybe I'll just ask my question, and you can respond.
Sure. I'd love to, Your Honor.
But did Bruin address the ability of law enforcement to seize a firearm? And you can respond during rebuttal. I mean, you noted that the state didn't file... anything regarding this recent Bruin decision, any supplemental authority letter.
Nor did it file, this is true, Your Honor, nor did it file a response to the Frein case, which followed Bruin. But
I guess I'm wondering, does Bruin address the issue that before us?
It does, Your Honor, because the right to self-defense is a fundamental right that existed before the Constitution, and it doesn't depend on where somebody is, and it doesn't influence how many pistols they have or where that pistol is at any given time. And the legislature made it very clear in the concealed carry statute that there is no limit to a number of pistols that a lawful concealed carry permit holder can have. And the Frein case made it clear that the state police's arguments, like the state patrol's arguments, are meritless. That, we can take this firearm without infringing on his Second Amendment rights because she or he can go out and buy another one. I've gone slightly afield, but
yeah,
I'll...
As you ponder, I mean, we'll come back to this, I suppose, during your rebuttal, but I didn't see any cases that you relied upon that would indicate a constitutional violation for temporarily removing a firearm during the course of an investigation where there's a potential serious assault alleged or involved. So.
I did, Your Honor. The PPS case cited the exceptions, and we did cite the Minnesota statute 626.04A, which is the petition to get the property back. No exception that PPS identified, particularly the illegality on the face of the property, and no exception under 626.
I don't want to take away any of your 5 minutes, so go ahead and take a pause, and we'll come back to you.
Thank you, Judge Ross.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent. I should have mentioned this earlier, but you see there are three microphones. If you're comfortable using the middle microphone, you may. If you'd rather use one of the side microphones, you certainly may as well, in the interest of our COVID pandemic response. Entirely up to you.
My name is Kathleen Greishi, G-H-R-E-I-C-H-I. I'm an assistant attorney general appearing today for Trooper Brian Helgett and for the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Your Honors, the court correctly dismissed the amended complaint in its entirety on Rule 1202. The crux of this case is the squad car video and the State Patrol's dispatch video. And that they're important for two reasons. First of all, having these obviate any need for discovery. We know exactly what Trooper Helgett knew from dispatch as he was approaching the scene, and we know exactly how what happened during the investigatory detention. Second, the video conclusively shows that Trooper Helgett acted reasonably and lawfully at all times throughout the detention. Accordingly, he is entitled to qualified immunity on the constitutional claims and to official immunity on the state common law claims.
Can I probe you a little bit there? So if this were a criminal case, we ordinarily would just go right to the district court and look at what the district court found as what occurred, any disputed facts, looking at the video, hearing testimony in a motion to suppress, for example, on Fourth Amendment grounds. But in a Section 1983 claim, questions of reasonableness usually would go to a jury. Can you address whether that difference matters in this case where the issue revolves around the appropriateness or inappropriateness of treating these circumstances under Rule 12 versus Rule 56?
Well, because we're relying on qualified immunity, Your Honor, which is strictly a legal decision. Was there a constitutional violation? And more important, and then step two, was there established case law setting a bright line that that such conduct would violate the Constitution? So we are in the realm of legal decisions, not jury decisions.
Thank you.
Appellant's lead argument seems to be that the district court committed reversible error by considering materials outside the pleadings. You know, this is a puzzling and baseless argument. Look no further than appellant's brief at page 15. Judge Schleter was looking at paragraph 165. Take a look at paragraph 178 of the amended complaint. It's beyond dispute that the video and the dispatch recording, the audio, that they were appended to the amended complaint. It might be helpful for the court if I explain a little bit about this document 23A that that appellant was referring to. So at the beginning of this case, I initially put in motion to dismiss papers, and instead of responding with an opposition, appellant responded with an amended complaint. Now, in my initial motion papers before the complaint was amended, the initial complaint did not physically append the video and the audio, but it did incorporate them by reference. It relied on them. It clearly incorporated from them and referenced them. So I did put in a declaration where I brought them forth for the court's consideration. So appellant.
Can I ask counsel on that point? Do you see any distinction in the law of the defendant submitting the documents that are referenced in the plaintiff's complaint, and then the court taking it into consideration in Rule 12?
I think that it would have been appropriate for the court to consider them if that initial set of motion papers had gone forward. I know there's the McClendon v. Roy case where this court did that. The defendant put in video that the court relied upon.
So just to clarify, your client submitted them for a motion before the amended complaint referenced them?
Well, there wasn't an amended complaint yet. So the initial complaint referenced them, but did not physically append them. So in bringing my motion, I put them as exhibits to a declaration for the court to consider. And I do that in many cases. It's permissible.
Well, it is permissible. Ordinarily, I will tell you from my own experience, is that district courts then convert the Rule 12 motion into a Rule 56 motion when parties begin to submit information or documents or videos outside the record. Correct me if I'm wrong about that.
Yes, I don't agree with that, Your Honor. It's only if the materials haven't been relied upon and referenced and incorporated by reference into that pleading, the complaint. And if I had submitted something that hadn't been incorporated by reference in that initial complaint, yes, then the court would convert it to summary judgment. But this is material that's like germane, spread throughout the initial complaint, which isn't really before us today.
And what would you say is the most supportive case for that nuance in the prop, that nuance in the fact that if it's mentioned by in the complaint, but not attached to the complaint, that the other party providing the entire thing that is referenced, whether it's a contract, whatever, that then becomes part of the complaint as opposed to it being attached by the complainant.
Yeah, I would direct the court's attention to the 35W Bridge case that we've cited and to the that McClendon v. Roy case. And I would also add that that's really academic here, because that question, the court doesn't have to reach that question, because I wrote a motion to dismiss an amended complaint, and the amended complaint clearly appended the video and the audio as exhibits. And the reason I continued referring to it as, you know, Exhibit A to Document 23 is because when plaintiff appended them, he didn't designate clear markings. I didn't know how to refer to it as a specific document item in the docket.
But there's no dispute that we're talking about the same video, the same
correct.
Attachment.
Correct. It is the same video.
So just hypothetically, if the district court should have decided the motion as one for summary judgment, would that be reversible error? Given the sequence here, and if we were to disagree and conclude that it should have been treated as a motion for summary judgment, would that be reversible error?
I suppose if the court disagrees that it was a summary judgment question, that that it would need to be remanded. But when one reads the district court's order, it's very clear that the court will come down with the same decision, that there's no dispute in the facts that the officer acted reasonably and lawfully at all times during this investigatory stop. Appellant talks about these two chapters, what happened, the contact between the drivers when they were out on the freeway, and then talking about what happened on the shoulder of the road, ending with the weapon being taken away by Trooper Halgett. And, you know, in his supplemental filings and the rest of his argument, it's pretty clear he's going to a chapter three, which is how appellant went about retrieving the gun from the evidence room. Not from Trooper Helgett, by the way, but from the evidence room. But that's not the proper framing of this case. The only relevant facts are what Trooper Helgett knew from the dispatch audio as he was arriving on the scene, and the conduct and his conduct at the scene during the detention. Again, I just want to emphasize that in a motion to dismiss, the facts in the amended complaint have to be accepted as true. Appellant has put in this video, the squad car video, and the audio too, right? The audio of the dispatch call. He's put those, attached those to the complaint, so those have to be accepted as true as well.
Can you address appellant's argument that the district court cherry-picked in its consideration of the materials attached to the complaint?
I view that as a baseless argument. If the panel considers the district court's order, it's very clear that the district court judge looked at the video in its entirety.
Looked at the video in its entirety is different from analyzing all of the parts of the video, including those parts that might tend to favor the plaintiff's position.
Any facts that plaintiff has raised that theoretically, in his view, favor his position were made out of earshot of appellant and were made at non-critical phases in the encounter. You know, for example, the comment about, gosh, he's, you know, has some mental health concerns and is on these meds, yet he has a permit to carry. That was made at the very end after he had released appellant, and he was making that comment to another trooper.
What about the reference by the trooper that essentially I would have done what he did, suggesting that the behavior was non-criminal and that the trooper was aware of that?
If things were as appellant says they were, appellant says that the other motorist was banging on his door, you know, shouting, banging on his door and, you know, trying to get his door open. There's conflicting story from the other motorist.
I'm talking about what I just mentioned. Focus on that. Did the district court include in its analysis of reasonableness the trooper's recorded statement suggesting, if you take the draw all the inferences in favor of the non-moving party, that that the trooper was aware that there was no criminal violation because the trooper would have handled the situation exactly as the plaintiff did?
I can't agree that the upshot of the order is the trooper was aware, didn't think there was a criminal violation. What happened here was the trooper, he didn't know. He knew that there were some skirmishes on the freeway. There was a rear-ending purposely through the fault of one or the other of the motorists.
Oh, I'm sorry. My question is just, did the district court, the argument is the district court didn't give, in response to Judge Cochran's concern or question about potential cherry-picking, did the district court address that circumstance?
If memory serves, the district court did talk about the large size of the other motorists, and I don't think that the court needs to delineate every single fact.
I'm just asking whether the district court did.
I believe the district court did, if memory serves. If memory serves, I thought that the district court did talk about the size, the big size of the other.
I was referring specifically. I guess maybe I'm being too vague in my question. So I think the position that the appellant is asserting is that there was enough here for the district court to conclude, at least for the purposes of a preliminary motion, that the trooper arguably was aware that the appellant's conduct didn't constitute a criminal violation at a point early enough that would have ended the handcuffing sooner or maybe not involved it at all.
I guess I don't agree with that because, so the trooper, he did the interview of appellant in the squad car first, right? Then he goes to the other motorist, and on the way back to sort of finish off the paperwork and get folks on their way, he had made the decision, hey, I don't know if a crime has been committed here. This needs to go to the county attorney. This is a decision for the county attorney. My job is to make sure folks leave this scene safely. I leave here safely. Both motorists leave safely, and the public is protected. And I also have an obligation to make a report and to retain this weapon because it may be potential evidence of a crime. I just don't know. That's a decision for the county attorney. That's not a decision for me right now. I can't make that determination. And I think that comes through loud and clear in the district court's order. It certainly comes through loud and clear on the video.
Doesn't appear to be any further questions from the panel, and your time has expired. So thank you for your argument.
Thank you.
Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I will use the best I can. This is really important to emphasize the application of Rule 12 and Rule 56 in this case, and beyond, you know, in addition to the constitutional arguments, and that makes this case more complex than maybe it should be. But Rule 12 is very, very clear that when the district court considers materials outside the four corners of the operative complaint, the court shall convert it to Rule 56 analysis. Not maybe, not discretionary, and it shall commit, allow reasonable discovery. Those are the plain words of Rule 12.
Mr. Nikitas, you, in answer to Judge Ross's question, I thought you said that the Northern States Power, the NSP case, was the most strong for your argument. And just looking at the what they describe as a threshold issue, and it appears to be whether the court considered documents for Rule 12 motion without converting it to summary judgment. But the point there is they were not referenced in the complaint. And so, in fact, they were referenced in the motion for Rule 12, as I recall. So the whole point, I guess I'm getting at, is do you disagree? And if you do, what case would you point us to that when they are specifically referenced, which there's no dispute they were referenced here in your client's complaint, and those alone were the documents considered by the trial court, was error?
Okay. First question, and then comment on NSP and Martins, Your Honor. Best case is Federated, because the Seventh Circuit took the district court to task for cherry-picking that obviously took place. And we have cherry-picking here at the district court. You know, total omission of Trooper Helgett's admission. This guy's a big boy. I would have done the same. He has a right to defend himself. I would have done the same thing. Now, back to your question about NSP. NSP doesn't help the respondents because the Supreme Court affirmed disposition at Rule 56. And the Supreme Court rebuked the Minnesota Department of Transportation and the district court for misplaced reliance on the Supreme Court's decision in Martins from 2000. And I quoted that part from NSP and Martins in my reply brief, and I'll read it again. Quote, in Martins, we limited, quote, our review to the particular documents and oral statements referenced in the complaint. So that's a limitation. The pleading that was the subject of the motion to dismiss. Thus, having considered the affidavit, it was error for the district court to not to have treated the motion as one for summary judgment under Rule 56. Now, I want to get to a point that the respondents raised about immunities. The law is very clear when a party is trying to dispose of a case at Rule 12, the immunity must appear on the face of the complaint. Well, the district court cited eight materials outside the amended complaint. The respondent cited nine references outside the amended complaint to argue in favor of immunity. That's a reversible error right then and there. And we have the Wissman case and later Boddy case from the Eighth Circuit that holds us. There has never been an appellate decision, published or unpublished, by the Minnesota courts disposing of a case on immunities at Rule 12. And I brought the court's attention to the unpublished Stressman case. I considered that persuasive. There were some similar facts because it was denied, went up to the Supreme Court. They affirmed it, went back down, and the court denied affirmed the denial.
That's certainly so, but ordinarily, I mean, you have a complaint and then you have discovery, where in discovery you get a video or some other fact. And so then Rule 56 is necessary because it's outside the pleading. So, and I guess maybe we're just talking around
sure.
the same issue.
If I may, Your Honor, I did identify within the reply brief what discovery and why Mr. Scheffler wants to do on remand, deposing Trooper Helgett, deposing Sergeant Stather, Sergeant Dix. You know, what did the State Patrol know? When did they know it? Why did they hold on to it for 11 days? Why did they release it on the 22nd? Why was it released while the State Patrol continued to investigate Chapter 1? And that's important discovery. The respondents gave us a good reason why on remand this court should have instructions to assign it to a different chamber of the district court. The respondents say the district court's going to decide it the same way. Well, let's have on remand another set of eyes, just as honorable and just as well trained, should have a look at it, because Mr. Scheffler fears being prejudiced if the respondents say that the district court's going to decide it again the same way. The court should reverse, remand, publish, and assigned this to a different chamber of the district court. Thank you very much, Your Honor. Oh, and McClendon was unpublished, decided on different grounds. 35W was affirmed on denied Rule 12, and it ruled referred to a contract case in dictum. Reverse remand, publish, and assigned to a different chamber. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you. And thank you, Mr. Nikitas and Ms. Gracie, for your written submissions and for your oral argument today. Very helpful to the court. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
And have a good afternoon.
You too, Your Honors.